was raised in the predominantly white neighborhood of Corona. His father was a cook and servant who worked for a state senator, his mother a housewife with diverse interests. She spoke French and German, played the piano, enjoyed the theater, and counted Ellington drummer Sonny Greer as one of her childhood friends. "Music to me was a way of holding on to Negro culture because there wasn't very much of it around," Taylor has recalled. At age five, he began studying the piano. Lessons were supplemented by instruction from his piano teacher's husband, a timpanist who had played under Toscanini, an especially fitting early association given the extremely percussive nature of Taylor's mature style. In 1952, Taylor entered the New England Conservatory of Music, where he expanded his knowledge of contemporary classical music, but grew disenchanted with the Academy's indifference to the black musical experience. The same period found Taylor deepening his knowledge of the jazz idiom. Writer Nat Hentoff, who first met Taylor around this time, has recalled that no one had clearer, firmer, and more unexpected opinions about music than Cecil. This confident sense of direction was critical for Taylor, since his music, even at this stage, was increasingly deviating from the then prevailing styles of late bop and cool jazz. "By 1954, my style of playing was developed," Taylor has noted. A half decade before free jazz emerged as a controversial new movement, Taylor was already employing arch dissonances, fragmented improvised lines, disjointed rhythms, and the jackhammer piano attack that would characterize his mature work. His 1956 session for the Transition label indicates the scope of these experimental leanings. At first hearing, Taylor's approach reveals a number of connections to the jazz tradition. The repertoire here draws heavily on standards based on conventional song forms, and the instrumentation is a typical jazz combo. Taylor is supported by bassist Buell Neidlinger and drummer Dennis Charles, as well as, on some tracks, by saxophonist Steve Lacy. But on a deeper level, the music is unflinchingly subversive. Taylor sometimes follows the chord changes played by Neidlinger, other times imposing his clashing polytonal structures on top of them, elsewhere trying to undermine any assertion of an underlying harmonic roadmap. His piano attack, with its rumbling thick chords and caustic single-note lines, is somewhat reminiscent of Thelonious Monk's. But in place of Monk's sly humor and masterful use of space, we encounter a more treacherous and overgrown aural landscape. Restless, insistent, at times foreboding, this is music that seemingly bypasses the listener's faculties of judgment and evaluation, and instead heads straight for the central nervous system. During the late 1950s and early 1960s, Taylor recorded and performed on only a handful of occasions, but each of these outings further reinforced his image as the most intransigent of the young jazz modernists. He shook up the audience at the 1957 Newport Jazz Festival, where his performance was recorded and released. A stint at the Five Spot in New York spurred further controversy and attracted an enthusiastic following among artists and bohemians. Follow-up recordings for Contemporary and United Artists, including a session that paired the pianist with John Coltrane, found Taylor playing in a vein similar to the Transition releases, employing ponderous dissonances and an acerbic piano attack in dramatic reworkings of standards, supplemented by probing new compositions. In 1960 and 1961, Taylor had the opportunity to record for the short-lived Candid label. The Candid work finds Taylor at a new level of musical maturity and reveals a number of stylistic devices that would achieve fuller expression in his mid-1960s recordings for Blue Note. He is less constrained by chord changes and bar lines. His link with the bop tradition of Powell and Monk is less overt. His playing is more textured, more two-fisted. The demarcation between soloing and accompanying, between comping chord and melody line, vital distinctions in mainstream jazz, are now overridden by oceanic torrents of sound. Taylor still plays the occasional standard, such as Lazy Afternoon and This Nearly Was Mine, performances that border on reconstructive surgery, and engages in stock devices such as trading four-bar phrases with a drummer on Air. But these last lingering affectations of traditional jazz playing do little to blunt the porcupine quills of his prickly music. A second Candid session from 1961, ostensibly under the leadership of bassist Neidlinger, found Taylor refining these same techniques. Cell Walk for Celeste, from this date, underscores the formalist elements often hidden beneath the apparent free-form flow of the pianist's work. This 88-bar theme captures a number of distinct moods, ranging from brooding melancholy to sardonic exultation. The piece represented Taylor's most successful endeavor to date in blending contemporary classical elements into a distinctly African-American style. Almost as though riding in on the morning train from Danbury, Charles Ives got off at 125th Street instead of Grand Central Terminal, is how Nidlinger later described the performance. Downbeat awarded Taylor its prestigious New Star Award in 1962, but this did little to improve his commercial prospects. Gigs for me have been mostly, like, a concert a year, filled in with one or two short nightclub or coffeehouse gigs, Taylor told author A.B. Spellman around this time. To support himself, Taylor took jobs as a dishwasher and short-order cook. But in 1966, Taylor burst forth with a number of important projects, including two milestone dates for the Blue Note label and a live recording made in France. Unit Structures, recorded for Blue Note in May, stands as a landmark performance for Taylor, a full flowering of the promise shown on Air and Cell Walk for Celeste. Conquistador, from this same period, is less well known, but an equally impressive statement of the pianist's mature style. The flow of time in Taylor's music was, by this time, completely free of conventional jazz metrics. Taylor's collaborations with drummer Sonny Murray during the early 1960s had assisted in this process, one furthered by the pianist's later work with Andrew Cyrille. Cyrille played an important role on Unit Structures, varying his attack from the ominous reverberations and asides of Enter Evening to the explosive interjections of Steps and Tails, Eight Wisps. Despite the absence of typical swing and bop phrasing, these pieces maintain, for most of their duration, a powerful rhythmic dynamism. The essentially physical nature of the performance comes across even on record. Single note runs burst from the piano sounding board. Short, acidic phrases crack like a whip. Inquisitive chord voicings tremble, stutter, bellow. Tone clusters ripple up and down the keyboard. The horns crisscross arrhythmically on top of these layers of sound, entering into haranguing dialogues with the rhythm section and each other. In the final analysis, Unit Structures ranks with Coleman's Free Jazz, Ayler's Spiritual Unity, and Coltrane's Ascension as defining statements of the free jazz movement as it matured in the early 1960s. But of these four efforts, Taylor's is the most controlled and multidimensional. No vestiges of sentimentality, no easy resolutions or soothing cadences deflect the sharp edges in this music. Yet it equally avoids empty emoting and unrelenting Sturm und Drang exhortation. Taylor remained a voluptuary with the heart of an aesthetic. Even when this music achieved paroxysms of release, an overriding austerity lingered just below the surface. Taylor's efforts during the 1960s solidified his reputation as the most uncompromising exponent of the jazz avant-garde. With the jazz revival of the early 1970s, Taylor emerged as a respected elder statesman of the music, a surprising twist for this erstwhile revolutionary. But this was an uneasy process at best, and Taylor often found ways of subverting the established institutions that now tried to embrace him. Taylor was invited to teach at a major university, then caused an uproar by failing a large number of students and defying administration pressures to change the grades. Taylor played at the White House, but scampered away from the bandstand after his performance, with the President of the United States, who simply wanted to give the pianist a compliment, forced to hustle after him. Taylor agreed to perform in tandem with the swing-to-bop modernist Mary Lou Williams, but rather than meeting Williams halfway, Taylor all but overpowered her playing with an explosive accompaniment of avant-garde piano technique. Yet by the close of the decade, Taylor, for all his aloof exterior, had developed an unmatched skill in working the system. On the back cover of his release, Three Faces, Taylor's record company boasts about its many sources of funding. This disc was made possible through grants from American Broadcast Companies, Armco Incorporated, Capital Cities Communication, Dow Jones, Mr. Francis Golay, Gilman Foundation Incorporated, Occidental Petroleum Corporation, the Rockefeller Foundation, Sony Corporation, Union Pacific Corporation, and the National Endowment for the Arts. In time, Taylor would possess a curriculum vitae that few mainstream jazz players could dream of, with his Guggenheim Fellowship, NEA grants, MacArthur Genius Grant, and even an honorary doctorate from the New England Conservatory of Music, of which he had been a fierce critic in earlier years. He was voted into the Downbeat Jazz Hall of Fame by the critics in 1975, while McCoy Tyner, Keith Jarrett, Herbie Hancock, and others, perhaps more popular but less iconoclastic, had to wait another quarter of a century to join him. The militant outsider, it seems, had become the consummate inside man. Yet Taylor's music stayed at the outer fringe despite his growing eminence. The 1970s were especially fertile years for Taylor's solo piano work. Silent Tongues from 1974 was a major statement, with Taylor moving deftly from subtle quasi-classical moods to erupting volcanoes of dissonance. Other solo outings, Air Above Mountains, Buildings Within, Fly, 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 Indent, rounded out this picture of the keyboardist as human howitzer. At such times, Taylor almost succeeded in making solo jazz piano into an athletic exhibition. No one in jazz, or any other music, had ever attacked the keyboard so aggressively, had created such big sounds, had so overpowered the instrument. One expected strings to break and bits of ivory and ebony to chip off the keys. The experience of seeing Taylor in such a vein could be riveting, convincing even free jazz non-believers of the persuasive power of his muse. Although Taylor found that he was in most demand now as a solo performer, he resisted pigeonholing, continuing to broaden the range of his activities. His efforts increasingly went beyond the confines of instrumental performance, expanding to include chalk screeching on the blackboard vocals, ritualistic chanting, stylized body movements, poetry, the oddest fragments of cultural bric-a-brac. But even when seated at the keyboard, Taylor broke new ground. He was commissioned to write and perform a piece for ballet artists Mikhail Baryshnikov and Heather Watts. He composed and played for the Alvin Ailey Dance Company. He wrote for larger ensembles. He also continued to work in smaller combos, sometimes joined by longtime sideman Jimmy Lyons, an associate from the early 1960s until shortly before Lyons' death in 1986, whose full-toned alto work served as a firm anchor in the midst of Taylor's aural tidal wave. Taylor's massive recording project, Cecil Taylor Berlin 88, was perhaps his most panoramic venture of the period. This multi-disc project, some 12 hours of music, found the pianist in collaboration with a wide range of players, many of them European, in settings spanning solo piano, duos, combos, and large bands. The pioneering efforts of Taylor and Coleman had blossomed, by the mid-1960s, into a full-fledged movement. Former sidemen of these pioneers now emerged as major performers in their own right. Archie Shepp, who had worked with Taylor in the early 1960s, formed a quartet with Bill Dixon and later participated in the New York Contemporary Five with Don Cherry and John Cicai. Shepp would also stand out as one of the most articulate publicists for the music, speaking frequently on its links to progressive political movements. Cherry went on to enjoy a successful career following his departure from Coleman's band, initiating a relationship with the Blue Note label that resulted in major works, Complete Communion and Symphony for Improvisers. A series of six concerts at the Cellar Cafe, organized by Bill Dixon, presented under the rubric of the October Revolution in Jazz, further legitimized the movement and featured Cicai, Roswell Rudd, Paul Blay, Milford Graves, and Sun Ra, among others. In total, some 40 groups graced the bandstand, playing mostly to capacity crowds. The success of this venture led to the formation of the Jazz Composers Guild, an umbrella organization for sponsoring the music of the avant-garde. John Coltrane's conversion to the freestyle around this same time reinforced the expanding power and scope of the revolution. Only a short time before, Coltrane had been the leading light of mainstream tenor playing. Now, in a series of recordings, above all with his orgiastic 1965 release, Ascension, he emerged as one of the most radical of the new school. This formidable 40-minute performance found Coltrane and his rhythm section supplemented by a half-dozen horn players in a wild free-for-all, a superheated encounter that, for many listeners, served as the fitting, logical, and anarchistic endpoint of this quest for freedom. Follow-up projects, Om, Kulus e Mama, Meditation, featured Coltrane in different settings, but equally intent on pushing to the outer limits of tonality and structure. A host of free players gathered around Coltrane, including tenorists Shepp and Pharoah Sanders, joining him on record and in concert. Audiences reacted with mixed emotions to these demonstrations. When Coltrane performed a duet with Shepp at the Downbeat Jazz Festival in Chicago, the crowd split into factions, half cheering and urging on the musicians, the remainder shuffling restlessly, booing, many leaving. A similar divide was evident among jazz critics. Yet the true believers and caustic dissenters had, perhaps, more in common than they realized. Some listeners no doubt found a soothing catharsis in Coltrane's Ascension or Albert Ayler's Spiritual Unity, yet it is clear that many delighted precisely in the music's foreboding exterior. This latter group never pretended that shrill overtone squeals and distorted quarter-tone barks sounded mellifluous. It may not be going too far to suggest that the worse the music sounded, the better it suited their needs. Herbert Marcuse, the Marxist philosopher whose writings were widely read during this period, had built a theory of aesthetics on such grounds, celebrating art that refused to follow the strict ordering, the bureaucratic control, the confining rules of modern capitalist society. Jacques Attali, in his influential 1977 manifesto Noise, proclaimed that music, defined as the organization of noise, symbolically signifies the channeling of violence. Such views marked a stunning reversal from the ancients, who sought for the sublime, for harmony and beauty in works of art, instead substituting a fascination with disorder and discord. In practice, these attitudes could lead to surprising endpoints. One jazz critic, exulting in precisely this harsh exterior of the most progressive music, went so far as to brag that the records he recommended were precisely those that people were least likely to enjoy. It is impossible in the final instance to understand the full impact of the free movement without gauging this ethos, very much representative of the mid-1960s. Free jazz snubbed its nose at the established order, and in an era in which the establishment was increasingly under assault, this alone was a powerful rallying point. As such, the freedom movement shared in the same zeitgeist that gave birth to acid rock, campus demonstrations, and the 1960s counterculture. Both the advocates and detractors of the avant-garde sensed this to greater and lesser degrees, and though their debates often seemed to focus on the music, a deeper strain of discourse, politicized and ideologically charged, almost always underscored these interchanges. Simply put, what one thought about this body of work had much to do with what one felt about the prevailing state of affairs in society. Yet alongside this celebration of the anarchic elements in the music, a vague utopianism also emerged. Fans of free jazz hardly blinked when critic John Littweiler predicted that avant-garde music would be philosophically crucial to humanity as a whole and lead to a new consciousness that will deter mankind from its present catastrophic course. In a similar vein, David Such announced in his book Avant-Garde Jazz Musicians Performing Out There that free jazz helps life achieve purposefulness and points the way toward solving at least a portion of the problems and misunderstandings in the world. This profusion of grand claims and counterclaims was very much part and parcel of the progressive wing of the jazz world. One could probably determine this merely by looking at the album covers, which announced The Shape of Jazz to Come, or The Change of the Century, claims no jazz player in any other style would dare to make. Even after it became clear that atonality was not the end point of jazz, merely a stopping point in a constantly fluctuating scene, this sharply ideological component in free jazz, and even more in discussions about it, has persisted, almost as if the ways critics conceptualized jazz got frozen sometime around the late 1950s and early 1960s. With the passing years, free jazz has become just another style, but the very ethos of the music hardly allows its fans to settle for anything less than a preeminent position as the Hegelian endpoint in the history of jazz. Among the second wave of free jazz players, Albert Ayler would grasp with the greatest clarity the deconstructive phase the movement was now entering. He explained to interviewers that the goal now was to escape from playing notes and enter a new realm in which the saxophone created sound. In contrast to Ornette Coleman, many of whose solos could be notated and analyzed for their musicological implications, Ayler defied such assimilation. The well-tempered scales of Western music were incapable of encompassing the bellowing, moaning spasms that fled from the bell of his horn. Ayler was a master of the dirty tone, that calling card of the African-American musical tradition with a lineage predating Louis Armstrong and Robert Johnson. He was a virtuoso of the coarse and anomalous, with an impressive bag of tricks at his disposal, stomach-churning waverings out of tune, low-register barks and high-pitched squeals, a vibrato so wide that it bordered on parody, darting phrases, hieroglyphics of sound representing some hitherto unknown sublunar mode, tones Adolf Sax never dreamed of and Selmer never sanctioned. yet there was also a traditional side to Ehlers' music. His compositions frequently featured unadorned diatonic melodies, which contrasted starkly with his heated free jazz improvisations. Ballads found Ehlers' expansive vibrato lingering over simple whole-note and half-note patterns. On faster compositions, Ehlers' efforts often sounded like lilting folk songs evoking quasi-European vernacular music of another place, another century. These influences coexisted with more specific African-American sources of inspiration, the residue of Ehlers' personal history. In his native Cleveland, where he was born in 1936, Ehler performed saxophone duets in church with his father, who also introduced his son to swing and bebop jazz styles. During Ehler's teens, formal saxophone study was supplemented with work in jazz and rhythm and blues bands, as well as summer stints on the road with bluesman Little Walter. In his early 20s, Ehler served 3 years in the military, playing in army ensembles, occasionally gracing the bandstands of European jazz clubs while stationed overseas, and listening to the free jazz sounds that were beginning to gain wider exposure. Ehler's first recordings, made during the early 1960s in Scandinavia, find him fighting against the constraints of the mainstream jazz tradition. By 1964, however, Ehler had developed his mature style, distinguished by an untempered excitability. Ehler had meanwhile found a group of sympathetic fellow travelers to support his explorations. Drummer Sonny Murray, a master of free-time percussion, bassist Gary Peacock, who could move with ease between conventional structures and atonality, and was especially skillful at exploring the ambiguous middle ground between the two. Don Cherry, who frequently sat in with Ehler and joined his band on a European tour. Witches and Devils, Ehler's February 1964 quartet date, showed how completely the tenorist had broken away from the customary jazz vocabulary. Elements of Ornette Coleman and John Coltrane are more prominent in his playing, but they too are subservient to Ehler's rougher, looser conception. Murray's drum kit is the epicenter of unsettling reverberations hinting at underlying rhythms, but never resolving into conventional time. The ensuing trio recording, Spiritual Unity, which featured Ehler alongside Murray and Peacock, was a major statement, the most cohesive ensemble project the saxophonist had undertaken to date. Ehler showed that his radical remaking of the jazz saxophone vocabulary was largely self-sufficient, needing no other horns to set it off or support its blistering attack. It encompassed fervent explorations of harmonics, haunting string-like evocations in the higher register, and Vesuvian explosions of sonic lava. Peacock and Murray hold on to these energized lines with a determination of cowpokes latching onto steers at the rodeo. To their credit, they grapple masterfully with Ehler's unpredictable leaps and turns. Ehler's brother Donald joined as trumpeter in the band in March 1965 and remained a key colleague for the next 3 years. The younger sibling contributed uninhibited sound collages that complemented the saxophonist's fractious work. But he suffered from emotional instability and a drinking problem, which precipitated his firing from the band in 1968. In the latter half of the decade, Albert Ehler's music began to incorporate elements of a variety of vernacular styles. These included rock, R&B, blues, gospel, vocal harmonies, even bagpipe music. His 1968 release, New Grass, must rank among the strangest jazz albums of the decade, with its attempt to mix freedom music and formulas from the commercial hits of the day. Here, Ehler's untempered saxophony is backed by a hard-grooving rhythm section that includes Funkmeister drummer Bernard Purdy, and is overwhelmed by a team of sassy if undistinguished Motownish singers. This new direction was mostly lamented by fans of Ehler's earlier work, and did little to broaden his appeal among the dominant rock audience of the day. Shortly before his death, the saxophonist showed signs of moving away from these crossover efforts. In November 1970, Ehler disappeared, and some 3 weeks later his body was found in the East River. He was 34 years old. Death by drowning was the verdict of the New York Medical Examiner's office. Some commentators mused about foul play, with rumors circulating about a mysterious bullet wound in the corpse, although denied by pianist Cal Cobbs, who helped to identify the body. Others recalled signs of depression and mental instability that may have led Ehler to take his own life. Under other circumstances, the 1970s jazz revival would have surely given a major boost to Ehler's career, but his early death ensured that the accolades would be posthumous. Yet this saxophonist's period of peak creativity, for all its brevity, marked an important turning point in the history of jazz. Anthony Braxton has sometimes spoken of a post-Ayler era in the music, setting up this figure as a point of demarcation in the evolution of the avant-garde in jazz, a revealing nomenclature that helps us understand why so much later jazz retreated from a full embrace of the freedom imperative rather than try to move beyond Ayler into a further stage of liberation from the strictures of Western tonality. In truth, it was hard to conceive what freedom beyond Ayler might represent, since the saxophonist's bold leap outside the world of notes into the full flux of sound seemed more a liminal point than a springboard to the next thing. Perhaps then it should come as no surprise that, almost at the moment of Ayler's death, the biggest sensation in the jazz world was a rock-inflected album by Miles Davis called Bitches Brew that rudely countered rather than extended the avant-garde tendencies that had been so powerful during the previous decade. Fusion and Electronica. Jazz has always been a music of fusion. Nothing from New Orleans is ever pure, so goes an old throwaway phrase. But even by Crescent City standards, early jazz was an especially complex mélange. The Southern mentality that obsessively measured infinitesimal gradations, delineating differences of quadroon from octoroon the way Aquinas demarked archangels from cherubim and seraphim, quickly came to a cul-de-sac in tracing the lineage of this radical new music. Impure at its birth, jazz grew ever more so as it evolved. Its history is marked by a fondness for musical miscegenation, by its desire to couple with other styles and idioms, producing new, radically different progeny. In its earliest form, jazz showed an ability to assimilate the blues, the rag, the march, and other idioms. As it evolved, it transformed a host of even more disparate sounds and styles. It showed no pretensions, mixing as easily with vernacular musics, the American popular song, the Cuban son, the Brazilian samba, the Argentinian tango, as with concert hall fare. Jazz in its contemporary form bears traces of all these passages. It is the most glorious of mongrels. Yet the concept of jazz as music of fusion took on particular relevance at the close of the 1960s. Jazz was on the brink of an especially pronounced period of absorption and expansion. Over the next decade, the music's leading exponents would attempt ambitious fusions with a dizzying array of popular ethnic and classical styles. At times, the resulting hybrids would be so far afield from the music's tradition that listeners would ask in puzzlement whether the results could still be called jazz. Such experiments would even call into question the jazz world's most sacred legacy, the syncopated sense of swing. In its place, one now encountered a wide array of alternative rhythms, on-the-beat rock riffs, world-beat drones, smoothly flowing quasi-classical styles, and experiments in free time. The types of fusion would vary widely, from the ethereal concert hall overtones of the ECM sound to the grooving disco beat of jazz rock. But they shared an increasingly outward-looking focus. By the close of the 1970s, Buddy Bolden's legacy had truly conquered the world, but the New Orleans pioneer would hardly recognize his own progeny. It had become more than a style of music, it was a perspective that seemingly could encompass all musics. Yet, for most listeners during this period, the term fusion had a very narrow and specific meaning. It described highly commercial attempts to combine jazz with rock music. Miles Davis's recording of Bitches Brew at the close of the 1960s was a signal event in this regard. It legitimized a whole new area of exploration and experimentation for jazz musicians. This emerging rock-tinged sound substantially broadened the jazz audience, and one suspects that it played a decisive role in spurring the improving financial environment for all jazz styles during the 1970s. Fans who were introduced to jazz through fusion soon developed a taste for other styles of improvised music. As a result, the economic base of jazz broadened and stabilized during this period, after years of stagnation and decline. New clubs opened, jazz labels proliferated, and expatriate musicians returned from their overseas exiles. Sales figures for Bitches Brew provide an impressive measure of this change of affairs. A typical Davis mid-1960s release, despite the critical acclaim and lasting significance of this music, would sell fewer than 100,000 units at the time of release. But fans purchased 400,000 copies of Bitches Brew within its first year. Davis built on this new audience with a vengeance. He recorded prolifically over the next 18 months, amazing Columbia executives who had previously found it difficult to entice him into the studio. He showed up at company publicity functions and played on television shows. He agreed to perform in rock venues such as Fillmore West and Fillmore East, even when it meant serving as lead-in act for another band. Davis was also now working with a wider range of musicians and sounds. For instance, the Bitches Brew sessions found Davis using 12 sidemen, 10 of them in the rhythm section. Only Wayne Shorter was a holdover from the mid-1960s quintet. Some critics accused Davis of selling out, yet the remarkable thing about Bitches Brew was how little Davis attempted to mimic current trends in pop and rock music. All but one of the tracks lasted for over 10 minutes, virtually guaranteeing that Davis would receive little radio airplay. The songs studiously avoided slick commercialism. Listeners seeking tight arrangements, melodic hooks, simple dance beats, or memorable lyrics were inevitably disappointed. This was raw, unfiltered music, rambling, discursive, and often unwieldy. The large rhythm section created thick, soupy textures, and the bandleader remained coy, often allowing the sidemen to work over long static vamps before entering on trumpet. Even then, Davis's horn lines were far from solos in any conventional sense. Instead, they seemed just one more layer of sound, placed on top of the churning cauldron underneath. This record may be, as many claim, the father of 1970s fusion. Yet if so, one struggles to see its paternal resemblance to the overly arranged, ever-so-slick Grover Washington and Spyro Gyra releases it supposedly spawned. Davis built on this aesthetic vision in a series of follow-up projects. Producer Teo Macero took on an increasingly important role at this time, employing radical tape-splicing techniques to sculpt finished performances from the mass of studio and live material that Davis was recording. On the release of Davis's soundtrack music for the film Jack Johnson, one of the trumpeter's strongest projects from the period, Macero created a dramatic shift in Davis's piece Yesternow by incorporating excerpts from Shh, Peaceful, recorded over a year before with a different band. The contrast is unnerving and disjunctive, yet very much in keeping with the helter-skelter sensibility of the new Davis sound. Live Evil, from the same period, offers a similarly bizarre contrast, with the results of Davis's intriguing studio project with the quirky Brazilian instrumentalist-composer Hermeto Pascoal strangely juxtaposed with live performances of Davis's working band. At times it almost seemed as if Davis were defying the rock audiences who are now flocking to see him. Above all, he avoided the on-stage recapitulation of hit records, the time-honored formula for popular bands, in favor of a restless linking of sundry fragments set to a miasma of rhythmic sound. Yet the rawness of this music, one suspects, accounted for much of its commercial success. It displayed a rebellious streak that was in tune with the counterculture attitudes of the late 1960s, giving Davis credibility with younger listeners who probably would have been turned off by a slicker format. The proof of this came with Davis's 1972 On the Corner. Here, Davis was willing to employ more overtly commercial elements, especially more insistent dance rhythms. Yet critics mostly panned the new sound, and sales failed to meet Davis's expectations. With Bitches Brew, Davis had tapped into young and mostly white rock listeners. But with On the Corner and its follow-up projects, Davis looked to draw an urban black following. In truth, many of Davis's former sidemen were passing him by in this regard. In 1975, Davis was relegated to touring as warm-up act for Herbie Hancock, whose jazz fusion funk band Headhunters was reaching the same young black audience to which Davis merely aspired. The mixed reaction to his music was only one of many problems Davis now faced. An October 1972 car accident left him with two broken ankles. His left hip, which had been operated on years before, was increasingly in pain and often left him immobilized. A bleeding ulcer added to his medical complaints, as did nodes on his larynx that constricted his breathing and left him short-winded when playing the trumpet. His drinking and drug problems further contributed to his deteriorating condition. Despite these aggravations, Davis continued an active schedule, undertaking concert performances in Japan in early 1975 that were recorded and eventually released as Agartha and Pangaea. But these were parting shots. Soon, Davis had retired from the music scene. By his own admission, he did not pick up the horn for over 4 years and rarely left his home. Yet the fusion movement, Davis's legacy, was now entrenched as the most commercially viable jazz style of the period. Former members of Davis's various bands were taking the lead in this area, with three ensembles proving especially influential: Chick Corea's Return to Forever, John McLaughlin's Mahavishnu Orchestra, and Weather Report, co-led by Wayne Shorter and Joe Zawinul. But this represented only part of the impact of former Davis sidemen on the new idiom. Hancock's 1973 Headhunters release achieved massive sales and brought many younger listeners into the jazz camp with funk-oriented pieces such as Chameleon and an updated version of Watermelon Man. This album initiated a bifurcated career for Hancock, with his efforts now divided between mainstream jazz, often of the highest quality, and overtly commercial projects with little jazz substance. His 1970 release, Feats Don't Fail Me Now, found him lamely singing, albeit with the aid of a voice synthesizer, and regurgitating a vapid pseudo-disco sound. Yet around that same time, Hancock participated in a stunning two-piano concert tour with Chick Corea and an impressive reunion with the VSOP band, essentially a regrouping of the mid-1960s Davis Quintet, with Freddie Hubbard filling Miles's role. In later years, Hancock would prove to be something of a chameleon himself, with projects that showcased his mainstream jazz skills, quartet, directions in music, his world music interests, the Imagine Project, his taste for funk and electronica, Perfect Machine, and his celebration of diverse songwriters, Gershwin's World, The New Standard, River, The Joni Letters, the latter release earning a Grammy as Album of the Year in 2008, the first time a jazz record had been so honored since Getz Gilberto back in 1965. George Benson, whose guitar work had graced Davis's Miles in the Sky release, made a more successful switch to vocal work. His mid-1970s cover version of Leon Russell's This Masquerade from the Breezin album initiated a series of pop hits for Benson, a success that threatened to obscure his talent as a soloist in a West Montgomery vein. Tony Williams's Lifetime band, which included organist Larry Young and guitarist John McLaughlin, was not as commercially successful as Hancock's or Benson's fusion efforts, but provided an even more sophisticated blending of rock energy with jazz instrumental prowess. Many lesser-known Davis associates, Erto, Lonnie Liston Smith, Michael Henderson, and others, would never achieve the success of Headhunters, Breezin, or Bitches Brew, but also sought, with varying degrees of success, to seize the momentum of the moment in attracting a crossover audience for their own bands. Chick Corea had already established himself as one of the most prominent jazz pianists of his generation when he founded his Return to Forever fusion group toward the close of 1971. Corea's early professional efforts found him working in both jazz ensembles and Latin bands. His mainstream jazz approach, as it evolved, boasted a clean, sharply articulated piano sound, a mix of modal and impressionist harmonies, and a driving, on-top-of-the-beat rhythmic feel. His 1967 sideman work on Stan Getz's Sweet Rain project already bespoke a mature piano stylist and composer. And his 1968 leader date, Now He Sings, Now He Sobs, drew much-deserved praise as one of the most creative piano trio projects of the period. Around this same time, Corea joined Davis's group and participated on Bitches Brew and several follow-up recordings, but by the start of the 1970s, Corea had left the trumpeter to explore freer structures in his Circle band. In addition, Corea's exceptional two volumes of piano improvisations for the ECM label from 1971 showed him refining a more song-oriented style, one that became even more prominent in Return to Forever. This ensemble, formed in 1972, found the keyboardists assisted by a strong cast of accompanists, especially bassist Stanley Clark and later guitarist Al Di Meola. Both virtuoso instrumentalists who could match Corea in moving from electric to acoustic settings and creating an appealing blend of jazz, rock pop, and Brazilian Latin sounds. Corea was especially adept at incorporating the latter elements into his compositions, as demonstrated by the crossover success of his pieces La Fiesta and Spain. In the 1980s, Korea increasingly played in a trio format, for a time reuniting with veterans Roy Haynes and Miroslav Vitus, who had participated in the Now He Sings, Now He Sobs project, and later forming a dynamic ensemble with bassist John Patitucci and drummer Dave Weckl. Like Hancock, Korea was now alternating between electric and acoustic settings, yet without the sharp disjunction of styles revealed by the former's efforts. Indeed, the same Korea Patitucci Weckl group would perform alternately as the electric band and the acoustic band, with the two approaches revealing a marked convergence. Later Korea groups would play variations on these themes and encompass everything from gritty acoustic combos, such as the new trio with Avishai Cohen and Jeff Ballard and the beefed-up Origin Sextet, to electric supergroups as demonstrated on the 2008 Return to Forever reunion and the 2009 five-piece band collaborations with John McLaughlin. Along the way, Korea has recorded duet projects with everyone from vocalist Bobby McFerrin to banjoist Bela Fleck, performed classical works, and even composed his own piano concerto and string quartet. As with so many of his peers, Korea's embrace of jazz-rock fusion has ultimately proven to be merely one facet of a career that is ultimately more eclectic than electric. John McLaughlin worked in Tony Williams's Lifetime band, as well as on Davis's early fusion efforts, before branching out on his own with the Mahavishnu Orchestra in 1971. Born in Yorkshire, England, in 1942, McLaughlin was active in the London scene, where he played not only with jazz groups, but also alongside rock musicians such as Eric Clapton, Mick Jagger, and Jack Bruce, before moving to the United States in 1969. The Mahavishnu Orchestra's music reflected McLaughlin's deep rock roots. In many ways, Hendrix was more of a role model for these efforts than Miles, an orientation that was heightened by the absence of a horn player in the band. Yet McLaughlin's interests also ranged over many genres beyond jazz and rock, as witnessed by his facility in flamenco, demonstrated in his later collaborations with Paco de Lucia, Indian music, highlighted in his late 1970s band Shakti, and the classical acoustic guitar tradition, increasingly evident in the 1980s and 1990s, for instance, in his Guitar Concerto, premiered with the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra in 1985. Jazz writer Joaquin Berendt seemingly went out on a limb in the early 1970s when he claimed McLaughlin symbolizes the complete integration of all the elements that have played a role in today's music. Yet McLaughlin's later career has tended to substantiate this high-flown praise. Like Korea and McLaughlin, Joe Zawinul and Wayne Shorter worked on the Bitches Brew sessions, only to leave to form their own fusion band at the start of the 1970s. The resulting supergroup Weather Report would rank as one of the most popular and influential jazz bands of its day. Both Zawinul and Shorter had come of age in the hard bop era. Shorter apprenticed with Art Blakey while Zawinul had worked with Cannonball Adderley, for whom he wrote the hit Mercy, Mercy, Mercy. This blues-drenched funk piece must have seemed to listeners at the time an incongruous output from the Vienna-born, conservatory-trained Zawinul. Yet this same sensitivity to dance rhythms and popular styles assisted Weather Report in its rise to fame. With Weather Report, Zawinul used his many electric keyboards to create orchestral layers of sound and a much more compositionally oriented style than the other fusion bands of the era were pursuing. The line between soloist and accompanist was blurred. In its place was a flowing electronic ambience in which the band would move between different grooves and composed vignettes. The group's biggest hit, Zawinul's piece Birdland, from the 1976 release Heavy Weather, was a stirring example of this approach at its best. The piece shifts between several contrasting moods, underlined by distinctive pulses and textures, culminating in a simple, catchy melody locked atop a perky harmonic and rhythmic foundation. With its sophistication and tunefulness, and above all its variety and compression, such an approach can be viewed as the aesthetic of Ellington, applied to the dominant electronic pop style of the 1970s. Yet there were crucial differences between Ellington and Weather Report. Duke's band had been marked by a consistency of personnel, with many players staying for decades, while Weather Report went through frequent changeovers, with only Zawinul and Shorter maintaining the band's continuity. But even more telling, where the Duke had built his compositions around his soloists, Zawinul preferred to submerge the individual musicians into the total atmosphere of his pieces. In time, Wayne Shorter's fans began to grumble that one of the great saxophonists in jazz was being relegated to occasional fills and interludes, and would point to Shorter's mid-1970s work with the VSOP Quintet and his stellar 1974 leader date, Native Dancer, with Milton Nascimento, as better vehicles for his talents, not to mention his classic Blue Note leader dates and jazz messenger efforts from the 1960s. Yet to Zawinul's credit, one must acknowledge that his negation of the soloist allowed him to craft an innovative, quasi-conversational approach to composing. Melodic fragments might be stated by an instrument and inspire a response from an equally unpredictable direction. Stitch by stitch, these scraps of sound were woven together into impressive, large-scale works. The arrival of electric bassist Jaco Pastorius in the band during the mid-1970s represented a jarring contrast with his collectivist ethos. Brash and flamboyant, Pastorius defied the stereotype of the bassist as the behind-the-scenes member of a jazz combo who hid out next to the drummer. He was a charismatic figure who dazzled audiences and introduced legions of rock fans to the intricacies of jazz. Who else could have inspired countless teenage bassists to learn Charlie Parker's intricate Donna Lee bop line on their instrument? Yet Pastorius's flashy recording of this piece proved to be one of the most admired and emulated fusion outings of the decade. Critics sometimes dismissed his onstage antics as the work of a superficial showman, but Pastorius usually backed up his posturing and pouting with prodigious technique and remarkably pure intonation. His presence energized the Heavy Weather recording, as well as many other sideman and leader projects. One of the most noteworthy of these sideman appearances came on Bright Size Life, a 1976 release that represented the debut leader date for guitarist Pat Metheny. Metheny arrived on the scene at a late stage in the jazz-rock fusion movement, and his career can be seen both as a final culmination of this movement's potential and also as a sign of the jazz world's desire to move beyond the constraining formulas of the genre. Certainly, Metheny's music has frequently defied categorization, running counter to the expectations of the fusion audience. One suspects that much of his artistry is intertwined with this very ambivalence about adapting to commercial demands. At the height of his career, Metheny recorded a densely atonal project with Ornette Coleman, almost as a way of distancing himself from the increasingly vapid commercial jazz scene with which he was associated. A few years later, Metheny once again surprised his audience by taking on a sideman gig with young tenor titan Joshua Redman. But even back at the time of Bright Size Life, Metheny showed a knack for integrating pop rock elements into a probing jazz style while studiously avoiding the clichés of both idioms. Although Metheny is a masterful technician, teaching guitar at the Berklee Jazz Conservatory while still in his teens, his playing avoids the empty demonstration of finger facility so common among jazz rock guitarists. Instead, he has refined a lucid melodic style that, at its best, merits comparisons with the incisive electric guitar work of Wes Montgomery. The addition of the like-minded keyboard soundscapist Lyle Mays to Metheny's band in 1976 spurred an especially fruitful partnership documented on recordings for the ECM and Geffen labels. Metheny's most impressive achievements in the fusion idiom have been a series of genre-crossing recordings, Still Life Talking from 1987, Letter from Home from 1989, and Secret Story from 1992, that incorporate advanced jazz compositional techniques with pop rock and Brazilian elements. These are highly original projects that sound deceptively simple, yet include some of the most sophisticated jazz writing of the late 1980s and early 1990s. Periodically, Metheny has returned to more mainstream settings, most notably in collaborations with Charlie Hayden, Brad Meldow, and Jim Hall, where he reveals a chamber jazz sensibility that contrasts markedly with the loud and boisterous tendencies of the fusion style. Like Metheny, the Brecker brothers established themselves as fusion masters without first passing through a period of apprenticeship with Miles Davis. Yet these talented siblings, saxophonist Michael born in 1949 and trumpeter Randy born in 1945, were already journeyman players with deep jazz and rock roots by the time they released The Brecker Brothers on the Arista label in 1975. Michael had worked with Horace Silver and Billy Cobham, while Randy had played on the first Blood, Sweat, and Tears album, as well as with Art Blakey, Horace Silver, and Larry Coryell's The 11th House. Even after they had become marquee artists, both brothers continued to supplement their leader dates with frequent sideman appearances and were in great demand as session players, In time, their instrumental work would be featured alongside a veritable who's who of late 20th century popular music stars, including Bruce Springsteen, Paul Simon, Frank Sinatra, Joni Mitchell, Frank Zappa, and James Taylor. But the Brecker brothers were jazz musicians first and foremost, and their most characteristic work mixed large doses of hard bop and modal music with rock and funk elements in an appealing hybrid. Michael Brecker would emerge as an especially influential post-Train stylist. His rapid-fire technique and mastery of a seemingly endless array of patterns and licks, married to a hard, cutting tone, made him the perfect saxophonist to survive in an age of guitarists, a flamboyant soloist who could rise to the occasion, whether he was working with an intimate jazz combo or on a festival stage surrounded by mountains of amplification and thousands of fans. While other fusion stars struggled to maintain their audience when the new traditionalists emerged on the scene in the 1980s and 1990s, Michael Brecker didn't miss a beat. His post-Brecker Brothers leader dates often took on a more mainstream guise, with fewer rock-funk elements, yet he was just as prepossessing, flying over the changes of the old standards as grooving over a funky backbeat. Most historical surveys of the fusion movement have focused on bands with deep jazz roots, such as Weather Report and Return to Forever. Yet many of the most creative efforts in the fusion idiom came from rock musicians who borrowed and adapted the techniques of jazz. Even before Bitches Brew, the rock bands Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears had successfully married a jazz horn section to a rock rhythm section. The latter's recording of Billie Holiday's God Bless the Child from their 1968 debut album was as creative as any of the efforts coming from the jazz side of the fence during fusion's heyday. Woody Herman alumnus Bill Chase took a similar approach with his invigorating early 1970s band Chase, which matched four trumpets with a rock rhythm section and vocalist. Rock guitarists were also expanding their use of jazz techniques with great success during this period. Jimi Hendrix's efforts in this regard were so successful that they in turn influenced jazz musicians such as Davis and McLaughlin. The more soul-oriented recordings of Sly Stone and James Brown were also acknowledged as important precedents for many jazz fusion players. During this period, the group Steely Dan was proving that pop rock could equally benefit from a healthy dose of jazz. On projects such as Pretzel Logic, Katie Lied, Asia, and Steely Dan co-founder Donald Fagen's solo project, The Nightfly, the results were quirky yet appealing, delighting fans with a new type of electrified art song suitable for FM airplay. The presence of jazz icons as guest artists, Wayne Shorter and Phil Woods made cameo appearances with the band, no doubt raised the level of Steely Dan sessions, but even the lowliest accompanists on these projects were studio demigods with serious jazz chops. Recordings of this caliber proved that fusion was a two-way street, and that for every hard bopper who went electric, there were creative pop acts raising the level of their music through a judicious borrowing of jazz stylings. In contrast, Frank Zappa's connections to the jazz idiom were mostly hidden behind an outlandish onstage persona, yet his projects from the late 1960s and early 1970s, such as Hot Rats, Uncle Meat, Waka Jawaka, and The Grand Wazoo, represent, on the whole, some of that period's most ambitious and effective examples of the integration of jazz, as well as many other techniques, into a rock setting. Zappa always chose to distance himself from jazz. It was, he joked, the music of unemployment. On other occasions, he would announce, "Jazz is not dead, it just smells funny." Yet his music during the period 1969 to 72 was so permeated by the jazz fusion vocabulary that it sometimes seemed as if Zappa were on the verge of abandoning his rock roots. His choice of sidemen, including prominent up-and-coming fusion bandleaders George Duke and Jean-Luc Ponty, furthered this stylistic shift, while the demands of his intricate writing ensured that Zappa's groups, perhaps alone among the rock bands of the day, could match many major jazz combos in terms of breadth and depth of musicianship. As the 1970s progressed, Zappa cut back on the jazz trappings of his music and sold more records as a result. The mass audience clearly preferred Zappa engaging in novelty songs such as Valley Girl and Dance and Fool, rather than as a competitor to Miles or the Mahavishnu Orchestra. Yet his music from this period of flirtation with fusion deserves more respect from the jazz world. As the 1970s were wrapping up, the golden age of fusion was coming to a mostly unhappy ending. Weather Report continued to record new albums until 1986, but the later installments of the band matched neither the commercial success nor critical esteem it had achieved a decade earlier. The following year, Jaco Pastorius, who had left the band in 1981, died as the result of a beating at the hands of a nightclub doorman, but substance abuse problems and mental instability had already effectively ended his brief reign as a fusion star. Return to Forever had split up even earlier, disbanding after the 1977 Music Magic release. Except for a brief get-together in 1983, the group would not reassemble until its 2008 reunion tour. Mahavishnu Orchestra also disbanded in 1976, although it too attempted a 1980s reunion. Even Miles Davis took an extended break from the scene, all but disappearing from 1975 to 1981. By the time he returned, the fusion movement he had set in motion was clearly in decline. Did this signal that the integration of electronic sounds into jazz had been a failed experiment? Hardly. If the heroic age of fusion had ended, a new era of electronica had begun. Jazz artists continued to experiment with technological tools after the 1970s, but now they were just as likely to involve a laptop computer or a piece of studio equipment as a synthesizer or electric guitar in the center of the stage. Sometime, even low-tech devices managed to shake up the proceedings. Herbie Hancock's successful single, Rocket, from his 1983 album Future Shock, surprised many listeners at the time by featuring Grand Mixer DXT scratchin' records, in essence moving them back and forth by hand on a turntable to create various patterns of sound, usually highly rhythmic in nature. Even open-minded jazz fans may have had a hard time accepting a turntable as a musical instrument, yet resistance would gradually soften as scratches, loops, and samples, as well as programming tools of various sorts, found their place in the jazz world. The rise of acid jazz a few years later, with its borrowings from soul, jazz, rap, house music, and other sources, made increasingly clear the old roots that often served as fuel for these new sounds. Acid jazz, despite the U.S. origins of its various musical ingredients, was a distinctly international movement from the start. It first gained widespread popularity in London at the close of the 1980s, where Giles Peterson, credited with coining the term acid jazz, and other disc jockeys, experimented with combining classic jazz recordings with percussion tracks and electronic dance beats. The sound quickly gained an enthusiastic following in Japan, Germany, Brazil, Eastern Europe, and other locales, as well as in the United States. The band Us Three, which also came out of the London music scene, followed a similar borrow from the classics formula, underscoring their rap lines with hard bop elements sampled from the Blue Note catalog. Anyone who had doubts about the potential listener appeal of these mix-and-match styles need only look at the sales figures to understand the commercial potential of sampling jazz recordings. Us Three's debut recording quickly became the fastest-selling jazz rap effort to date, attracting many buyers who neither hung out at dance halls nor went to jazz clubs. The band became the first Blue Note recording act to go platinum, selling 1 million copies in the United States, an ironic turn of events given how much of the creative energy on this CD resulted from appropriating the work of jazz legends who had never enjoyed much financial success. Around this same time, a tribe called Quest borrowed samples from a host of jazz sources, Cannonball Adderley, Art Blakey, Freddie Hubbard, Jack DeJohnette, for its pioneering 1991 release, The Low End Theory. This disc went platinum and was selected by Time magazine in 2006 as one of the 100 best albums of all time. Yet with A Tribe Called Quest, Us Three, and many of the other first-generation bands drawing on jazz material in the rap acid jazz community, the music stopped short of a true fusion, settling instead for a parasitical relationship in which tasty licks and grooves were plundered from old hard bop, soul jazz, and fusion records and made subservient to the intentions of their new young masters. Input from the jazz side was usually second-hand, a matter of drawing on the archives as needed. However, by the mid-1990s, more ambitious efforts to combine original jazz and contemporary black popular music were underway, many of them involving respected jazz players such as Max Roach, Branford Marsalis, Steve Coleman, Greg Ospey, and Donald Byrd. Rapper Guru, born Keith Edward Elam in 1966, collaborated with a number of seasoned jazz artists in crafting an appealing hybrid of hip-hop and jazz for a series of albums released under the name Jazzimataz. These projects sold well in the United States and overseas, proving again that a jazz musician could play a role in this music as more than just a source for a sample. One suspects that such participation by first-rate jazz talent, not just through digital borrowings but in the flesh, will prove critical if this hybrid style is to become an influential part of the jazz tradition. Certainly, a rapprochement of this sort between hip-hoppers and instrumental improvisers must be seen as a promising development by those who feel that jazz needs periodically to renew its ties to current popular music and dance styles. Had Miles Davis lived longer, he would no doubt have played a significant role in this process. At the end of his life, he made clear his interest in finding common ground between the two worlds of jazz and hip-hop. Then again, almost every shift in the jazz sensibility during the last half of the 20th